Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And welcome to the month of November. And when we receive the new Science of Mind magazine at some point, it will be filled with gratitude. So for now, we will happily return to the September issue, which we did not get to share with you, and do some readings from there. And the September Daily Guides were written by Mary Davis. With overflowing love, I offer to you, my friends, this daily conversation about finding the way home to our passion and purpose. After 30 years of reading Science of Mind magazine's daily guides, I travel full circle by bringing these reflections to you. Gratitude rises within me for the gift of your loving presence on this journey of the spirit. May the following meditations illuminate the unique and beautiful calling of your soul. Mary Davis is a wisdom seeker, spiritual teacher, visionary, graphic artist, and mystic entrepreneur. She is the author of Everyday Spirit, a daybook of wisdom, joy, and peace, and the Everyday Spirit Gratitude Journal. After receiving her nursing degree, she spent many joyful years as a musician, songwriter, producer, piano teacher, and yoga instructor. She completed her Compassionate Bereavement Counseling certification in 2017 and works with parents who have lost children and those in hospice end-of-life care. She has a house by the sea and lives a contemplative life in harmony with nature. An updated hardcover edition of Everyday Spirit is available now. Learn more at, all one word, everydayspirit.net. Every act of love matters. Regardless of what has happened to you in your life, regardless of how young or how old you think you might be, there's power within you that's greater than the world. Dr. Michael Bernard Beckwith. In back of me is the potential of the universe. I declare new horizons will open for me and a better world of joy and peace will be revealed. Ernest Holmes. I once heard a story of an 8-year-old boy who opened a lemonade stand and raised thousands to feed those experiencing homelessness. When I researched it, up popped 7 other examples of kids who did the same thing, and that was just on the first page of the search. Young hearts filled with compassion change the world with love. When we water seeds of compassion at a young age and encourage children to experience the beauty of unconditional love, those seeds will grow and flourish for the rest of their lives. My psychiatrist brother John once told me of an older woman who suffered from severe depression. She lived alone and rarely left her house except to go to church. When asked what she did with her time, she mentioned her love of propagating African violets. John encouraged her to share her plants with those in need. When someone from the church died or was sick, perhaps she could bring a plant to their family. She did just that, and within a few years, she became the African Violet Lady. She would quietly bring beautiful plants and handwritten notes to the porches of those in her church community who were suffering, and she lifted many lives with her love. It doesn't have to be lemonade or an African violet. It can be the results of your unique talents. You are never too young or too old to make a difference. Every act of love matters. Dreams at any age can change the world. Affirmation. I am an ageless, timeless being of love. I am never too young or too old to shine the light of my love in the world. Your heart knows the way. The place God calls you to is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Frederick Buchner. You are starting out on a great adventure. A wonderful journey. You are guided by love, inspired by truth, and your future will be what you make it. Ernest Holmes. As we awaken to the dawning of this new day, let's gather up the common threads of our journey into passion and purpose. To love and to be loved. To give and to receive, to be ourselves, to express our unique creativity, to forge a personal relationship with the divine. As we step out into the bright rays of hope, let's remember that small acts of kindness change lives, that following our curiosity can lead to our passion, that loving ourselves magnifies our love in the world, that co-creation with the divine is possible in every moment. As we stand under a new North Star, let's open to the mystery of the liminal space between heaven and earth, where our human emotions meet the spiritual being within. Let's listen when we are unsure. Let's rest when we are weary. Let's serve when we are called. On the first day of this month, there dawned an important truth that we can tuck into our back pockets for the journey ahead. We don't have to be healed, strong, and organized to consider our place in the world. We just need to be open, curious, and loving. Our purpose is rooted in our very hearts and fueled by the tender, infinite, unconditional love of divine source. As Ram Dass famously said, we are all just walking each other home. No need to worry because we can't get lost. Our hearts know the way. Just remember one thing. Love is the road. Affirmation. I journey in union with Divine Spirit on the path to my passion and purpose. I open my soul to all that is meant to flow into my life. We turn now to the November-December 2025 issue of Daily Word, published by Unity. Strength. God, Spirit, the universe, is my unfailing strength and support. If I doubt my ability to stay the course as I navigate challenges and move in the direction of my goals, I remember that through the power of divine strength within me, I have made it through every challenge I have faced. With each obstacle I have overcome, I've learned from experience, discovered new coping strategies, and grown resilient. I recall the strength that helped keep me going even when I wanted to quit, even when I wondered whether I could persevere. God, Spirit, the universe within me is the source of this strength, an inexhaustible well that can never run dry. I realize my past triumphs were not the result of my human faculties alone. I carry this knowledge with me as I encounter new challenges now. God, Spirit, the universe is with me, and I am strong. Freedom. I walk in freedom along the paths of life. Each day is an opportunity to live more fully from my spiritual nature. Spiritual freedom means there is an enduring reality beyond the limits and confines of worldly experience. This understanding helps me keep my life in proper perspective. Even if I have obligations to meet or other demands on my time, I can return my attention to the realm of spirit, where I'm perfectly and completely free and unfettered. I am liberated as I claim my spiritual freedom, knowing I choose my thoughts, feelings, and reactions. Even if I feel limited by my current circumstances, I can still do my inner spiritual work to claim my freedom in prayer and manifest it in my life. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, having the life you want by being present to the life you have, in the care of something unseen. Genius is a crisis that joins the buried self for certain moments to our daily mind. William Butler Yeats. We've been trained to think of genius as an unusual brilliance of mind, an ability to retain or calculate or conceptualize uncanny amounts of information. But the original sense of genius means attendant spirit, being in the care of something unseen but near. It is really another definition of wholeness or God, another way of acknowledging the Tao, the unseeable stream we all swim in. What Yeats offers us is an insight into life on earth. The great Irish poet suggests that crisis is an unexpected jarring of our ways that brings us into contact with our attendant spirit. I'm reminded that the Chinese ideogram for danger also means opportunity. This is not to suggest that we seek out danger, but that we look for the openings, when broken by experience, by which we can find our connection to the unseeable stream we often forget we are a part of. Perhaps the purpose in crisis, if there is one, is not to break us as much as to break us open. Sit quietly and feel the unseeable stream you are a part of. Breathe slowly and meditate on your genius, your attendant spirit. Breathe softly and expose whatever crisis you are in to your attendant spirit. If you can, move through your day feeling both your crisis and the depth of your genius. Let them join. We return to the Daily Word for the November affirmations. Inner peace. I'm at peace no matter where I am. Strength. The strength of God, of Spirit, of the universe, moves through me in every breath. Gratitude. All that I say and do is an expression of gratitude. Prosperity. I have more than enough, and I am grateful. World peace. I dedicate my Christ light to a world that is safe for everyone. And from the same issue, an article by Carmen Bennett, Walking in Gratitude Through the Storm. Gratitude comes easily in joyful moments and in response to good news, but I have learned that uncertainty, disappointment, and pain are conditions for truly life-altering gratitude. It does not always flow naturally, but can be an intentional choice, especially when life doesn't go as planned. When my plans took an unexpected turn, I found that repeatedly choosing appreciation helped me stay aligned with divine guidance, reclaim my power, and receive blessings I could not see coming. I had just put my children to bed when I saw the text message from my boss. "Can you call me?" I felt my stomach drop. It was rare to receive communication like that from her, so I knew something was wrong. My boss outlined a list of complaints that an intern whom I had supervised for a week had made against me. I had supervised several other interns and worked as a therapist at that practice for almost a decade. Thankfully, my boss made it clear that this was the first grievance against me she had received. She brought the intern and me together for a meeting to address the allegations, and it was resolved. Even in that unsettling moment, I felt a flicker of gratitude for a boss who believed in me and for my record standing on its own. Weeks passed, and I felt relief and even pride, having come through the experience unscathed. Then one night, I received a letter from the Licensing Board for Professional Counselors. I again felt my stomach drop, even before I opened it to see the intern's formal complaint. Although the board does not oversee supervision of graduate student interns, all complaints are subject to an investigation. I consulted an attorney, wrote and submitted a response, and met with the case investigator. Then I waited. I felt waves of anxiety and anger, but I grounded myself in the loving presence of God within. I kept returning to gratitude, giving thanks for access to legal support and the chance to stand in my truth. I felt myself growing stronger through adversity. In the meantime, I was excited to embark on a new professional venture, beginning a 3-year training program I had waited years to take. When I found out my training would take place at Unity Village, Missouri, a sacred place that holds meaning to me on my spiritual journey, I saw it as confirmation I was on the right path. After attending the first module, I received an email from the training organization. They inquired about the complaint made against my license, which I had disclosed during the application process. They asked for the outcome. After I informed them that it was still in process, they responded, "Your registration for the next modules will be on hold until we have resolution from the board." I felt confused, sad, and enraged. I didn't understand why things were not working out and how someone I barely knew could wreak such havoc on my life. I cried and wondered, "Why is this happening to me?" The next training module came and went without me, all without word from the board. As a member of a cohort, I would fall behind and would not be able to continue with my group. I grieved as I accepted that I would not be able to continue with the training. I felt lost. Then I remember Joseph's words in Genesis 50:20. "Even though you intended to do harm to me, God, Spirit, the universe, intended it for good." What a blessing to know that no matter what happens, I can experience God's protection and renewal. I acknowledged the harm and its impact, but I also recognized a greater purpose at work. But Spirit Within could not transform my life without my consent and participation. The power of appreciation aligned me with divine order and shifted my mindset. With that came a deep trust that nothing was in my way. My purpose doesn't lie on the other side of what appear to be obstacles, but rather the path that I walk is my purpose. I remained steadfast in faith, and my ability to trust the process of life allowed me to see the good flowing to me. I knew that I could transform the experience by seizing it as a chance to learn and grow. First, I turned inward and focused on self-care. An opportunity to practice self-compassion in real time lay before me. I allowed myself to feel my emotions, which helped me feel stronger. Like a storm that rains on a garden, pain watered the soil of new growth. Second, I examined areas for improving my supervisory work. The accusations against me were false, but I was willing to acknowledge my weaknesses. I used my anger as fuel for making positive changes, creating clearer expectations and guidelines, and being more attentive to my supervisee's documentation. Last, I saw the experience as redirection, not a block. I was willing to take the detour because I trusted Spirit Within was leading me. Listening to my intuition and guidance, I found myself walking a path I wouldn't have otherwise. I discovered a new training program that brought the spiritual dimension to my healing work and reconnected with my soul's purpose. Ultimately, that led me to open my own business offering spiritual coaching and guidance. I see the fruits of God's Spirit's, the universe's promise, deliver my highest good. But I got there because I did not wait for resolution to practice gratitude. Rather, gratitude helped me stay open to miracles, ready to receive the blessings meant for me. Carmen Bennett is the owner of Golden Hour Guidance, where she works as a professional counselor, spiritual coach, and intuitive healer. She lives in Columbia, Missouri, with her husband and two young children. We turn now to the November-December 2025 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and Enlightened Perspectives, Andrew Harvey on Becoming the Light During the Dark Night. For four decades, Indian-born British scholar and mystic Andrew Harvey has been preparing for this moment in history. He's written more than 30 books on topics including spiritual masters such as Jesus and Krishna, Rumi, yoga, Buddhism, and recently Mary Magdalene, the subject of his forthcoming book, The Magdalene Revolution, The Return of the Sacred Feminine and the Birth of Radical Equality. In that book, he presents Mary Magdalene as a female Christ who completes the sacred marriage of divine masculine and feminine. Earlier this year, Harvey's Shift Network online course, From Darkness into Light, Rising in Sacred Action to Transform the Forces of Destruction and Birth a New Humanity, brought together like and light-minded teachers, including Mirabai Starr and Matthew Fox, in galvanizing talks and practices in a conversation with contributing editor Karen Brailsford, including a follow-up call to him in the Himalayas. Harvey reveals how he's been personally radically transformed and how we can transform as well during these challenging times. Karen Brailsford, you foresaw the current state of the world, Andrew. Prophetic vocation is a wonderful and terrible thing. You have to be prepared to suffer very deeply and to give your life to the message you've been given to share. I'm in the happiest and deepest part of my life, and I'm willing to try to help people face the apocalypse we're in. Some of us who've been initiated into the great mystical traditions have been through their own dark nights, have seen the horror coming, and have dedicated their lives to trying to warn people. We've not given up. We have learned a great deal, and we have accumulated a lot of maps and practices and visions. We're ready to help, but it really depends now on whether people are ready to listen. I'm presenting the tools and everything I know the world needs at this moment. Karen, you possess a fury, a rage, and a passion about what's transpiring. Andrew, if you're not furious, outraged, and wildly angry in the deepest sense about what is unfolding, you have no hope of getting through such an intense crisis. I've been in America for 40 years because I knew America would decide the future of the planet. I've been trying to help this country claim its moral and spiritual responsibility. I hope to God that America has enough people who care enough about democracy, decency, and compassion, and who begin to resist and potentially risk their lives for the future, because that's what it's going to take to have a future. What I'm doing is seeding a vision of how even this terrible period that is coming could potentially be a birthing ground for a new humanity. Birthing such a race requires the understanding that there could be a deep divine meaning to this global dark night, which is to strip us to our depths so that we can rediscover who we really are, both human and divine, and come together in a worldwide, passionate revolution of love and action to save ourselves and live in justice and harmony with the environment. Great suffering can drive people insane and make them even more cruel, but it can also inspire, galvanize, and energize. Karen, are you hopeful a latter will happen? Andrew, the hope I have is in the divine in us, in the vision I and others are presenting, and in the power of practices that I know work from my own experience. The hope I have is in the depths of the crisis itself, because it seems that's the only way people will wake up to what is really at stake here. And waking up is the only path to survival. Karen, don't we first have to recognize our mutual divinity? Andrew, let's get real about what divine means. Divinity means dignity. If I truly think of you as divine, I'm going to treat you with care. If you're hungry, I will feed you. If you're homeless, you can sleep on my sofa. Even if I don't know you, I respect you. Divine means stepping in to help people who may be going through terrible things that I may also go through soon, because everyone does before the fat lady sings. Divine means justice. It means treating people with real eyeball-to-eyeball, hands-on compassion, not because they're brilliant or beautiful or rich or white or black, but because they are creations of God, of spirit, of the universe. That's the only way the human race can possibly survive. We won't be able to heal the multiple cancers of the soul if we don't get back to utter simplicity, one God beyond name and form. Everyone is its child. The whole of nature is radiant with its glory. We're on the earth to pay attention to justice, harmony, and compassion, and to create structures that support the whole of life. End of story. The only way through this is to accept where we are. We have to allow our hearts to be broken, our minds to be humbled. We have to let all the light and love rubbish blaze to ash so that we have a far more rigorous, far more humble vision of what the divine really is. The hope is that we're coming to a place where there is no choice. That has to happen before any chance of real transformation is possible. This revolution of the Divine Mother is very clear. It's saying, you must transform now and see that the climate is in free fall, that there are billions of people starving and living in repulsive conditions, that nobody is caring about the children being blown up in Gaza, and that in the Sudan, 25 million men, women, and children are threatened with hunger, which has been made worse by the United States withdrawing aid. The Divine Mother is out of her mind with pain and fury. She's saying, if you don't transform now, you will create a situation of such horror for everyone else and of such agony and horror for yourself. Karen, can you describe your 10-year dark night of the soul? Andrew, that's when I woke up from my trance and realized you can have all the light in the world, but there are people who want to destroy that light. You see the corruption, the insanity, the cruelty, and the way humanity has created systems that keep Black people impoverished and humiliated, that keep the poor tortured, that keep whole worlds in subjugation. And once you see it, you can't escape it. It's not losing your money or having a bad date. When you're in a real dark night, you're praying all the time not to be overwhelmed by agony. It is an incineration, an annihilation of your whole sense of identity, of everything you think you know. And the great gift is that you get to know you know nothing. I was a professor at Oxford at 21 and brilliant in the world's eyes. I thought that because I was so smart, I was in control and that I could understand anything from books. Only the dark night could have saved me from that because it knocked me off my feet and silenced me. It brought me to my absolute depths of utter disbelief and despair and saved my whole existence because I was no longer trapped in the old fool who thought he was something. What the dark night teaches you is that there's only one power. The dark night is where the hope is, the most hopeful in human life, because it's the one experience that will actually get you truly loving your enemy. You will see yourself in every suffering human being. There's nothing they're going through that you have not been party to yourself, and you will do everything you can to see that it never happens to another human being again. Karen, because it's all about oneness. Andrew, yes. But not this rubbish that they talk of in the New Age movement. Their oneness is marzipan oneness. Oneness is when you directly feel the agony of another human being. You're not just one with the light and the splendor and the sweet concepts in religion. Becoming one means being with those dying of famine, suffering with the woman wrongly incarcerated, and being outraged for those who are abandoned and marginalized. If you still think that sitting on your porch drinking an expensive tea, muttering a mantra, and feeling a vague oneness is going to help in any way, compared to the visceral unity you need to have with every suffering being in a crisis like this, you are already lost, and it's going to be very hard to wake you up. Karen, what message do you have for our readers? Andrew, please turn to the real guides. They're not the ones that you're being sold. Some of them are fine, but all of them are compromised because they've created brands that have stopped them from telling the full truth. It wouldn't have been good for their brand and their bank balances. I'm not claiming to be Jesus or the prophet. Peace be upon him. What I say to people is, stop being in denial. Prepare to be completely gobsmacked with pain, fear, horror, and despair. Yet, do not despair, because if you use that experience to go deep into divine practice in whatever path you are on, you will find that the divine, in whatever name you experience the divine, will come rushing towards you to give you visions of strength, power, truth, peace, and courage that you've never imagined. Plunge into spiritual practice. Love your friends. Do try and wake them up to what's happening. If you really love them, stay concentrated on being as patient, brave, and focused as you can. How deeply peaceful you need to be, how constantly attentive to others you are, and how absolutely humble you'll have to be may contain the secret of your own survival. Karen, 4 days before our first conversation, you experienced what you call the biggest disaster of your life. Can you describe what happened? Andrew, I've been through many dark nights and have had very profound mystical experiences in my life, but nothing like this. This was the definitive experience for me. I feel completely different. I feel installed in a calm, blissful, divine awareness, and it's embodied and peaceful. On May 6th, I wrote the preface to my upcoming book on Mary Magdalene. I had finally found the courage to say what I'd been wanting to say throughout the book, that we're living in the time of the Pentecost of Mary Magdalene. I ended the preface by writing that we're now being called to be singing flames of that Pentecost. I was elated and joyful, and then I went out to breakfast. I came back to find my condo devastated by fire and my beloved cat, Jade, dead. It was as if I lived, literally, the descent of the flames that purified, cleansed, and rebirthed everything. It was confirmation at the deepest level of the book that I had written and the path that I've been on. The next 5 to 7 years will determine the future of humanity. The flames of a very powerful new force are descending. What will seem like horror and chaos is actually preparation for the kind of rebirth I am now living. What this experience has done is confirmed 2 things. The destruction that is coming is terrible and unavoidable and will look like the end to many people. But it won't be the end because it's perfectly designed to burn away the false self that's creating all this tragedy and horror, and out of it will come a new humanity. I've just lived it. Karen, does having lived it make you an even more impactful teacher? Andrew, you can teach the map of this dark night rebirth process, but until you have lived it, it is a map with words. It's no longer a map with words for me. What I hope to be able to do is to model the new being for others so as to give them hope to go through whatever they have to go through to become one with the one. My teaching now is all about helping people to use the blessing of an extreme dark night to die into life, to simplify their lives, to dedicate themselves to radical service and sacred activism, and not to be terrified of what will seem so terrifying and be so terrifying. To realize it has a divine meaning, which, if they can surrender to it with gratitude, love, and hope, will rebirth them in a way that will completely astound them. Karen, are you now astounded? Andrew, oh yes, I'm astounded with gratitude. Every single day I experience overwhelming gratitude to have been on this journey and, despite myself, through grace, to have arrived at this place in which I know truth. Karen, can you comment on the huge interest in Mary Magdalene right now? Andrew, Mary Magdalene is coming back because what is absolutely essential for our world and the only hope for its survival is a massive absorption of the full power, glory, passion, peace, and radical, intense call for justice on every level of the divine feminine. The birth that is being offered us through this global dark night is the birth of an embodied divine human being. There can be no embodiment without the full return of the divine feminine, the full return of Mary Magdalene to the heart of the revelation. The revelation that Jesus and Mary came to birth together is far greater than any religion. What they modeled is the path to becoming a divine human being in your own right. They didn't come to be worshipped. They came to install a path of transfiguration, to show us how it's done and what it's for. How it's done is by surrendering your entire being to love consciousness. That creation and transfiguration of the divine must happen to create a human being who is capable of giving everything they are in sacred action, inner and outer, to help birth a new humanity and a new world. That is the Magdalene Revolution. The book is designed specifically to reveal the truth of the Mary Magdalene Revolution and also to help the reader integrate that truth for themselves, to birth themselves as a divine human being in and through the fiery and tender grace of Mary Magdalene. Andrew Harvey is a religious scholar and teacher of mysticism who has written more than 30 books. His next book, which will be published in February by Hay House, is The Magdalene Revolution. He's the founder and director of the Institute for Sacred Activism, advocating the fusion of mystical knowledge with compassionate action to address global crises. Visit Andrew Harvey, all one word, .net. And we have some November affirmations from Spirituality and Health. Inner peace. I'm at peace no matter where I am. Strength. The strength of God, of spirit, of the universe moves through me in every breath. Gratitude. All that I say and do is an expression of gratitude. Prosperity. I have more than enough, and I am grateful. World peace. I dedicate my Christ light to a world that is safe for everyone. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. We return now to the Book of Joy, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, with Douglas Abrams. Then we were in a section about lunch. The meeting of two mischievous people is wonderful. And we pick up with, scientists have found that we need love to survive. Our mothers show tremendous love and affection to us when we are born. Many scientists say that after birth, there are a number of weeks when the mother's physical touch is the key factor to developing the brain properly. After birth, if the child is isolated without the mother or physical touch, it can be very harmful. This is nothing to do with religion. This is biology. We need love. The Dalai Lama had first heard about this research in the 1980s from the late biologist Robert Livingston, who later became his biology tutor. Child neurologist and neuroscientist Tali Barham has conducted one of the more recent examples of this important field of research. She found that a mother's caress triggers activity that improves cognition and resilience to stress in a baby's developing brain. The mother's touch could literally prevent the release of stress hormones that have been shown to lead to the disintegration of dendritic spines, branch-like structures on the neurons that are important to the sending and receiving of messages and the encoding of memories. My mother was a twin, I said, and she was born prematurely at just 2.5 pounds, and she was in an incubator for 2 months without any human touch. Did it affect her? Archbishop Tutu asked. I think it affected her very profoundly. Now they have, what do they call it, Archbishop Tutu said, a kangaroo pouch. My wife Leah and I are patrons of a children's hospital in Cape Town, and one day we were visiting there, and this massive guy was carrying around the minutest baby tied to his chest so the baby could feel his heartbeat, and they said those babies have been shown to do much better. When Paul asked if I still had the picture of my own twin daughters just after they were born prematurely, when they were in the neonatal intensive care unit. One of our daughters had had a prolapsed cord, which was blocking her from descending through the birth canal, and her heartbeat and oxygen level was plummeting. The obstetrician, as she was trying to use a vacuum extractor on our daughter's head, had told Rachel that she had one more push to get the baby out, or they would have to do an emergency cesarean. Liana was already in the birth canal, so a cesarean was no guarantee of a safe delivery. As a doctor, Rachel knew, as I did, that every second counted as Eliana's oxygen level was getting dangerously low. I've never witnessed anything like the strength Rachel had exhibited as she threw herself headlong into the pain and wrenched every ounce of maternal will from her body to push our daughter out. Eliana was born blue, unresponsive, and not breathing. Her Apgar score was 1 out of 10, which meant she was barely alive. She was rushed to the crash cart, where the doctors tried to revive her and told Rachel to speak to her baby, the voice of the mother having an almost magical healing effect, even in the high-risk operating room. We waited for the longest moments of our lives as the doctors tried to bring her around, preparing to intubate her. And then, in a moment of unspeakable joy and relief, Eliana sputtered, took her first breath, and began to cry with life. The rest of us, including the obstetrician, were weeping tears of joy. After Eliana's traumatic birth, the twins were taken to the neonatal intensive care unit at the hospital. When I walked in shortly after, they were lying side by side, holding hands. The importance of love for our survival, which the Dalai Lama was describing, was not abstract to me, having witnessed the mother love that saved our daughter's life and that allows us all to survive. Oh, lovely, the Archbishop said, imagining the image. It's biology, said the Dalai Lama. All mammals, including humans, have a special bond with their mother. Without the mother's care, the youngster will die. That's a fact. Even if they don't die, they can grow into a Hitler because they have this huge sense of lack, the Archbishop said. I think when Hitler was very young, the Dalai Lama countered, he also was the same as the other children. This was the first time they disagreed in more than mischievous play. I think his mother showed affection to him or he would have died. Family members recount that Clara Hitler was indeed a devoted mother, although Hitler's father apparently was allegedly abusive. So the Dalai Lama continued, even today, these terrorists who received maximum affection from their mothers, so even these terrorists, deep inside, I think I have to take issue with you on that, the Archbishop responded. The people who go around becoming bullies are people who have a massive sense of insecurity, who want to prove that they are somebody, often because they did not get enough love. I think, yes, circumstances, environment, education all matter, the Dalai Lama replied. Especially today, there is not much focus on inner values in education. Then, instead of inner values, we become self-centered, always thinking, I. A self-centered attitude brings a sense of insecurity and fear. Distrust. Too much fear brings frustration. Too much frustration brings anger. So that's the psychology, the system of mind, of emotion, which creates a chain reaction. With a self-centered attitude, you become distanced from others, then distrust, then feel insecure, then fear, then anxiety, then frustration, then anger, then violence. It was fascinating to hear the Dalai Lama describe the process of mind that leads to fear, alienation, and ultimately to violence. I pointed out that so often our parenting in the West is too focused on our children and their needs alone rather than helping them to learn to care for others. The Dalai Lama responded, yes, there is too much self-centeredness also among parents. My children, that's biased love. We need unbiased love toward entire humanity. Entire sentient beings, irrespective of what their attitude is toward us. So your enemies are still human brothers and sisters. So they also deserve our love, our respect, our affection. That's unbiased love. You might have to resist your enemy's actions, but you can love them as brothers and sisters. Only we human beings can do this with our human intelligence. Other animals cannot do this. Having known the fierce and focused love of parenthood, I wondered if it was truly possible to love others with that same love. Could we really extend that circle of care to many others and not just our own family? A monastic could focus all their love on humanity, but a parent has a child to raise. I imagined that what the Dalai Lama was saying might be an aspiration for humanity, but was it a realistic one? Perhaps we would not be able to love other children as much as we love our own. But maybe we could extend that love beyond its typical boundaries. I wondered what the Archbishop, who was also a father, might say, but by now everyone had finished lunch. We would return to the elasticity of love and compassion later in the week, but tomorrow we would begin discussing the obstacles to joy, from stress and anxiety to adversity and illness, and how we might be able to experience joy even in the face of these inevitable challenges. Days 2 and 3, the obstacles to joy. You are a masterpiece in the making. It is very simple, the Dalai Lama began. Everyone knows that physical pain is bad and tries to avoid it. We do this not only by curing diseases, but also by trying to prevent them and by trying to keep our physical immunity strong. Mental pain is equally bad, so we should try to alleviate it as well. The way to do this is to develop mental immunity. We had started our second day of dialogues and were turning to the obstacles to joy. The subject of the dialogues was how to discover joy in the face of suffering, and we knew we'd need a full 2 days to discuss all of the ways that we suffer. As the Dalai Lama had said the day before, so much of our unhappiness originates within our own mind and heart in how we react to events in our life. Mental immunity, the Dalai Lama explained, is just learning to avoid the destructive emotions and to develop the positive ones. First, we must understand the mind. There are so many different states of mind, the diverse thoughts and emotions we experience on a daily basis, Some of these thoughts and emotions are harmful, even toxic, while others are healthy and healing. The former disturb our mind and cause much mental pain. The latter bring us true joyfulness. When we understand this reality, it is much easier to deal with the mind and to take preventive measures. This is how we develop mental immunity. And just as a healthy immune system and healthy constitution protects your body against potentially hazardous viruses and bacteria, mental immunity creates a healthy disposition of the mind so that it will be less susceptible to negative thoughts and feelings. Think about it this way. If your health is strong, when viruses come, they will not make you sick. If your overall health is weak, even small viruses will be very dangerous for you. Similarly, if your mental health is sound, then when disturbances come, you will have some distress but quickly recover. If your mental health is not good, then small disturbances, small problems will cause you much pain and suffering. You will have much fear and worry, much sadness and despair, and much anger and aggravation. People would like to be able to take a pill that makes their fear and anxiety go away and makes them immediately feel peaceful. This is impossible. One must develop the mind over time and cultivate mental immunity. Often people ask me for the quickest and best solution to a problem. Again, this is impossible. You can have quickest or you can have best solution, but not both. The best solution to our suffering is mental immunity, but it takes time to develop. One time I was talking with Al Gore, the American vice president. He said that he had lots of problems, lots of difficulties that were causing him a great deal of anxiety. I said to him that we human beings have the ability to make a distinction between the rational level and the emotional level. At the rational level, we accept that this is a serious problem that we have to deal with. But at the deeper emotional level, we are able to keep calm. Like the ocean has many waves on the surface, but deep down is quite calm. This is possible if we know how to develop mental immunity. Yes, the Archbishop replied, you have answered very well. You always answer well, but you have done this one quite well. The only thing I think is that people sometimes get quite annoyed with themselves unnecessarily, especially when they have thoughts and feelings that are really quite natural. Basically, the Archbishop continued, I think we've got to accept ourselves as we are, and then hope to grow in much the way the Dalai Lama described. I mean, getting to know what the things are that trigger us. These are things that you can train, you can change. But we ought not to be ashamed of ourselves. We are human, and sometimes it is a good thing that we recognize that we have human emotions. Now, the thing is being able to say, when is it appropriate? Throughout the week of dialogues, the Archbishop said many times that we should not berate ourselves for our negative thoughts and emotions, that they are natural and unavoidable. They are only made more intense, he argued, by the glue of guilt and shame when we think we should not have them. The Dalai Lama agreed that human emotions are natural, but he did argue about whether they are unavoidable. Mental immunity, he explained, is the way to avoid them. For months after our time in Dharamsala, I wrestled with this seeming disagreement. Is it possible to truly prevent negative thoughts and emotions, to develop what the Dalai Lama was calling mental immunity? Or are these thoughts and emotions inevitable? And should we, as the Archbishop was suggesting, just accept them and forgive ourselves for having them? Finally, after many discussions with psychological experts, it became clear that each position was valid and simply reflected a different stage in the cycle of emotional life. Through self-inquiry and meditation, we can discover the nature of our mind and learn to soothe our emotional reactivity. This will leave us less vulnerable to the destructive emotions and thought patterns that cause us so much suffering. This is the process of developing mental immunity. The Archbishop was simply reminding us that even with this immunity, there will be times when we will have negative or destructive emotions. And when this does happen, the last thing we want to do is judge ourselves harshly. In other words, the Dalai Lama was saying that if we eat healthy, take our vitamins, and get enough rest, we can stay healthy. And the Archbishop was saying, yes, even so, there will be times when we will catch a cold, and we should not make it worse by beating up on ourselves. So how do we deal with these obstacles to joy, the inevitable sources of suffering, both internal and external, that cause so much pain and anguish in our lives when they do arise? These range from the everyday troubles of stress, frustration, and worry, to the life-defining experiences of adversity, illness, and ultimately having to face death. We cannot control the inevitability of these occurrences, But both men agreed that we could influence their effect in our life by adjusting the attitude we take toward them. The first step is to accept the reality of suffering. The Buddha is supposed to have said, "I have taught one thing and one thing only, suffering and the cessation of suffering." The first noble truth of Buddhism is that life is filled with suffering. The Sanskrit word for suffering is dukkha, not to be confused with the nutty and very tasty Egyptian condiment, dukkha. The first is D-U-K-K-H-A, and the second is D-U-K-K-A. Dukkha can be translated as stress, anxiety, suffering, or dissatisfaction. It is often described as the mental and physical suffering that occurs in life, illness, and aging. It is also described as the stress and anxiety that arise from the attempt to control what is fundamentally impermanent and unable to be controlled. We try to control the moment, which results in our feeling that what is happening should not be happening. So much of what causes heartache is our wanting things to be different than they are. I think in many cases, the Dalai Lama explained, you develop some sort of unhappiness, some discontent, which leads to frustration and anger. While stress and frustration may sound like superficial problems or complaints, the Buddha identified them as the core of so much of our unnecessary or created suffering. I was reminded of what the Dalai Lama had said on our first day. We cannot end natural disasters or the suffering they cause, but so much of the rest of our suffering we can. Dukkha, or suffering, is the opposite of sukha, which means happiness, ease, or comfort. Both words are said to have originated from the ancient Aryans who brought the Sanskrit language to India. These Aryans were a nomadic people who traveled by horse or ox-drawn carts, and the words literally mean having a bad or good axle. Was it a bumpy ride, dukkha, or a smooth ride, sukha? Not a bad metaphor for life. What is suffering but a bumpy ride? Every life is rutted, and no one can avoid some inevitable bumps. But so much is determined by our own perception of the ride. Our mind is the axle that often determines whether we experience the ride as bumpy or smooth. This point was brought home to me in a rather literal way when I went to Dharamsala in January, several months before the dialogues, with Peggy Callahan. Peggy was responsible for filming the week in Dharamsala, and we went to prepare for the April visit. Our return flight from the cloud-covered Dharamsala airport was canceled, so we embarked on a bumpy and winding expedition to the nearest airport, holding tightly to the hand straps in the car as we bounced up and down and were tossed from side to side. We tried hard not to get carsick and distracted ourselves by telling each other humorous stories from our travels, stretching each story as long as possible during the bone-shaking 6-hour journey. We have perceptions about our experience, and we judge them. This is good. This is bad. This is neutral, the Dalai Lama explained. Then we have responses, fear, frustration, anger. We realize that these are just different aspects of mind. They're not the actual reality. Similarly, fearlessness, kindness, love, and forgiveness are also aspects of mind. It is very useful to know the system of emotion and to understand how our mind works. When a fear or frustration comes, we have to think, what is causing it? In most cases, fear is simply a mental projection. When I was young and living in the Potala, there was an area that was very dark, and there were stories about ghosts there. So when I was passing through this area, I would feel something. This was completely a mental projection. No, the Archbishop said with a frightened face. There were ghosts there, man. The Dalai Lama laughed and said, when a mad dog approaches, barking and gnashing its teeth, then you need fear. That's not a mental projection. So you have to analyze the causes of the fear. With frustration, often you see someone and you have a mental projection even when his or her face is neutral. Similarly, when you see someone's actions, you have a mental projection even when their behavior is neutral. So you have to ask yourself if your frustration is based on something real. Even if someone criticizes you or attacks you, then you have to think, why did this happen? This person is not your enemy from birth. Certain circumstances cause the person to be negative towards you. There may be many causes, but usually your own attitude is an important contributing factor that cannot be ignored. You realize that this happened because you have done something in the past that this person didn't like. So then when you realize your own part in the other person's criticizing or attacking you, the intensity of your frustration and anger automatically reduces. Then you also realize that basic human nature is good, is compassionate, and that the person does not want to harm you. So therefore, you see their emotion is due to some misunderstanding or misinformation. You see that this person's actions are due to their own destructive emotions. You can develop a sense of concern, compassion, even feel sorry for their pain and suffering. How sad that this person is out of control or having such a negative feeling. Instead of frustration and anger, you feel sorry for the other person and concern for them. I nodded my head and said, "But sometimes our frustration is not dependent on other people, but on circumstances beyond our control. For example, we can't control canceled flights." When I was young and very eager to go do something, the Dalai Lama said, then they would announce that there was a delay or cancellation of the flight. I would feel angry and sometimes angry toward the pilot or toward the airline. Before there was air service from Dharamsala to Delhi, I would go to the city of Jammu, about 4 hours' drive, to fly. So one morning, all the passengers were on the airplane when they announced that the flight had been canceled and that everyone should please leave the airplane. Later, I was told that the pilot did not come because he was drinking too much the night before. So everyone was complaining, and I felt frustrated too. Now, when an announcement comes that my flight is canceled or postponed, which does happen quite a lot here, I take it as a good opportunity to sit and do my practice, to sit and meditate. So now I feel less frustration. I was reminded of a flight that I had been on with Rachel, our then 2-year-old son, Jesse, and my mother to Hawaii. We did not have very much money and had booked seats on the cheapest airline we could find. They had only 2 planes that they would shuttle back and forth to Hawaii and other holiday destinations. We were almost halfway over the Pacific from California to Oahu when I felt a sudden jerk, like someone had shoved the plane from the side. Then the plane made a sweeping turn, and sometime later the crew made an announcement that we were heading back to San Francisco. I remember being very angry and frustrated. We had to spend the whole day waiting for another plane, so we tried to begin our vacation in California, taking Jesse to the zoo. It was fun, but I felt angry that our Hawaiian holiday was being cut short. When we finally returned to the airport and got ready to board, I overheard the pilot reveal to another member of the crew the reason for turning around. Apparently, one of the bolts had come loose in one of the engines. The pilot casually mentioned, in the way of people who are used to calmly handling high-risk situations, that if they had not shut off the engine at the moment that they did, it would have sheared off and the airplane would have crashed into the ocean. Suddenly, a delayed flight and a day at the zoo didn't sound so bad after all. I used to feel very frustrated and angry, the Archbishop said, when we would be rushing to a very important meeting and we would be stuck in traffic because there was an accident up ahead. You were grinding your teeth and looking for somebody to kick. But growing older, I said, well, this is an opportunity for being quiet. And then you would try to uphold all the people that were involved. I mean, there's not very much you can do, so grinding your teeth and getting heated up doesn't help. So why not use the old things that they tell you? Count to 10. 1, 2, 3, ah. The Archbishop pretended to lose his temper despite his trying to count to 10. I think it takes time to learn to be laid back, he continued. You know, it's not something that just comes ready-made for you. No one ought to feel annoyed with themselves. It just adds to the frustration. I mean, we are human beings, fallible human beings. And as the Dalai Lama points out, there was a time, I mean, we see him serene and calm, yet there were times when he too felt annoyed, and perhaps there still are. It's like muscles that have to be exercised to be strong. Sometimes we get too angry with ourselves, thinking that we ought to be perfect from the word go. But this being on earth is a time for us to learn to be good, to learn to be more loving, to learn to be more compassionate. And you learn, not theoretically. The Archbishop was pointing his index fingers at his head. You learn when something happens that tests you. And then he was pretending to be speaking as God might. Hello, you said you wanted to be more compassionate. Hello, you wanted to be a little more laid back. We get very angry with ourselves. We think we ought to be supermen and superwomen from the start. The Dalai Lama's serenity didn't come fully formed. It was through the practice of prayer and meditation that the gentleness, the compassion grew. His being patient and accepting, within reasonable limits. Accepting circumstances as they are, because if there are circumstances that you cannot change, then it's no use beating your head against a brick wall. That just gives you a headache. This is a veil of growth and development. I was struck by the phrase, a veil of growth and development, which seemed to echo the famous Christian notion that life is a veil or valley of tears from which we are freed only when we enter heaven. This expression is often said to be based on Psalm 84:6, which has the beautiful wording, "Who passing through the veil of tears makes it a well." Indeed, we can use our tears, our stress and frustration, as a well from which we can draw the life-giving waters of our emotional and spiritual growth. It's similar to how we learn how to be a parent, the Archbishop said as he concluded our discussion. You learn how to react to a child who is really frustrating you. You are better with your third child than you were with your first child. And so I would say to everyone, you are made for perfection, but you are not yet perfect. You are a masterpiece in the making. Fear, stress, and anxiety. I would be very nervous. We all have fears, the Archbishop explained. Fear and anxiety are mechanisms that have helped us to survive. You know, if you did not feel fear when you saw a lion over there and you just walked merrily by, in next to no time there would be no you. God has given us these things because God knew that we needed them. Otherwise, we would be fearless, but then we'd also be very stupid, and we would not be around very long. The problem is when the fear is exaggerated or when it is provoked by something that is really quite insignificant. When I asked the Archbishop how he managed the fear during the dark days of apartheid, when he received frequent death threats, he said, "Well, one did not do silly things like stand in front of a lit window at night, but one had to say to God, 'If I'm doing your work, you better jolly well protect me.'" I have always been impressed with how the Archbishop has been willing to admit his fears and frailties. We so rarely hear about the doubts, fears, and worries of leaders, as leadership itself seems to require an air of confidence that rarely allows the admission of weakness or vulnerability. I was once told an amazing story by former Time magazine editor Rick Stengel, who'd worked with Nelson Mandela on his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. Mandela was flying in a small propeller plane with his bodyguard, Mike, and the great leader was hidden behind the morning paper when he noticed that one propeller was not working. He leaned over and calmly told Mike, who informed the pilots. They were well aware of the problem and explained that emergency landing procedures were in place. When Mike explained the situation to Mandela, he nodded calmly and went back to reading his paper. Apparently, Mike, a tough guy, was trembling with fear, but only calmed by the image of Mandela, who looked unbothered by the fact that they might, at any moment, fall out of the sky. And we will continue with this story in the next week. For now, I wish you all a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.